Dr. Alan Hamilton, author of the book The Scalpel and the Soul, thank you for writing this book. I know it was out earlier in hardcover, and now it's out in paperback, and I highly recommend it. The subtitle is Encounters with Surgery, the Supernatural, and the Healing Power of Hope. How are you this evening?
I'm just fine, Ian. How are you?
Good. I'm assuming you don't have any surgeries in the morning.
No surgeries. No, I cleared the schedule out.
Well, I know you're a rooster and not an owl, so thank you for being an owl with us and staying up late instead of getting up early.
You bet. My pleasure.
All right. So I just got to tell you, there's one, I just right out of the box. Before I do that, explain kind of what your worldview is. As you came into life as a scientist, where you were in terms of supernatural experience or even just religious background, to what degree were you open to the things which you began to experience later as a medical scientist?
Well, I think like most people, I was religious as a kid. I was an altar boy, and then I kind of drifted away from things and really forgot about it. And I went to medical school, and I was a hard charger, and I made my reputation in molecular biology and computer guidance systems in surgery. So I really sort of think of myself as a pretty hardcore scientist, not really inclined towards spirituality and supernatural and things that you can't explain, that kind of thing.
Now, that having been said, you keep encountering things that you can't quite explain, and you can describe them, and you tell the stories well, but there may never be an explanation for some of these events. For example, the story that I told repeatedly today about when you were traveling on a dugout canoe in Africa. You have to explain to everybody why, as a medical, were you still a medical student? Were you a resident at that time?
No, I just finished, and I got assignment in Africa, and I was supposed to go out and immunize some villages. And in Africa, it's very difficult to travel except in the wet season where you travel by boat. And we had loaded up our boat, and that night the river had risen and actually taken our boat away, so we were delayed finding our boat and re-outfitting it, and then the next day took off down the river a day late. And the river had risen so high and had washed away so many landmarks that we couldn't tell where we were going on the river. And unfortunately, one way led to the Atlantic Ocean, and the other led to the village. And we were in a kind of a shaky dugout sort of canoe with a outboard motor on the end,
and you didn't want to end up in the Atlantic Ocean with that, especially
exactly.
With all of the gear. You had 100 pounds of this and that, and you were all loaded up for a canoe.
We were lashed and loaded. We had a grindstone. We had to grind our own needles back then, because we didn't have disposable needles, so we would grind them at night and boil them and get them ready for the next day, sort of thing.
To reuse hypodermic needles for immunization.
Exactly.
Okay, and then also we should mention the hippos.
Yeah, I got nervous when they had a Springfield rifle, and I said, what's that for? And they said, oh, it's hippos. It's hippo season, and they can get very angry and actually very aggressive, and we have the rifle just in case. And I thought, oh, this is going to be some trip down this river. And as we went, the guide said, I'm lost and I have no idea where we should go. And I said, what do you mean you're lost? And, I said, one side's going to lead us to the Atlantic Ocean. The other's going to get us to where we want to go, but you have no idea where we're going. And he said, no. And, we're hurtling down this river with this high water. And at the last minute, I said, we have to make a decision here, and the only decision I can make is let's crash land on the fork of this river. And we did, and we hauled our boat up, and we were soaked to the skin.
But just to take a moment to try to figure out, do we go left, do we go right? You're just going to haul over there at right before the fork, last time to make a decision to try to figure out where you're going.
Well, I have to tell you, several people have died on that river. There's a little graveyard at the hospital from people who died on the river, so I knew it was very dangerous. And I finally, at the last minute, said, you don't know where we're going. I don't. We got to crash land. And we did. We're lying on the ground, panting, covered in mud. And I look up, and there's this beautiful, handsome gentleman with an African native there with a big, beautiful hair of gray head, hair, and he looks down at us. And I said, "Oh, I'm so glad to see you. We're lost." And he says, "Yeah, I know." Kind of looking down at us like we're the most pathetic things that have washed up out of the river. And, I got all puffed up kind of a doctor style and said, no, you don't understand. We're here to immunize children in one of the villages. And he says, yes, I know. And I said, well, we're lost and we need somebody to lead us to the village. And she says, yes, I know. And I said, what do you mean you know? And he said, well, I had a dream. And in my dream, it told me to come here and wait at this particular spot in the river because you would be coming and you'd be lost. He said, but the strange thing is my dream told me to be here yesterday. And, you know, there were no cell phones. There were no smoke signals. There was no way he could have known we were delayed by one day because our boat had capsized and we had to re-outfit it.
That's just so freaky.
You know, I'm sitting there. I just got out of Harvard. I'm fresh from Boston, and I'm sitting in the middle of the African jungle going, wait a minute. My ability to function as a doctor is completely dependent on the dream of a perfect stranger.
Right.
And his faith in that dream to wait for 24 hours for me.
Yeah, so he had to wait here at that particular point. There's no guarantee that there's something so unlikely about that particular spot on a swollen river that he's going to wait there for 24 hours and then you crash land at that exact spot.
And all of this is in his dream, and his faith that his dream has told him something that's important. And I'm sitting now and saying, I'm completely dependent on this stranger and his beliefs in his dream. And that's when I sort of realized, maybe the world is working by a different set of rules than just the rules of science that I learned in medical school.
Love that. Now, even more so, though, let's discuss the other aspect of that particular trip before we move on to other experiences that you have that you recount in The Scalpel and the Soul, and that's the belief that there was a snake that lived in the river that ate white men.
Well, there's in Africa, it's sort of the whole world is infused with folklore, with myths, with legends, with supernatural influences. And there was this story that there was a big brown serpent, and the whole river was filled with mud, so it was like chocolate milk, and you couldn't see through it. And so the legend was there's this huge brown serpent, and it's living in the river, and it's waiting to eat white people. And the only way you can stay alive is by having a native guide. And it occurred to me this could be a kind of a commercial way to get a lock on the monopoly on who gets out on the river.
Exactly. No white guy's going to go out without a commercial guide nearby. Right.
Exactly. So, it seemed to sort of make sense to get out on the river with guides anyway. And that's sort of the habit that I adopted. And when I was finished and I was briefing the next doctor who was going to go there, I said,
the doctor who's a year behind you in med school,
exactly.
A doctor that is going to pick up the same program you're doing of immunizing young Africans.
Going to take my place. And I gave him a briefing. That was before PowerPoint. You brought your photographs and your slides. And then I said, oh, and by the way, there's this silly story about a brown serpent that lives in the river and he looks to eat white people. And, the story is that it won't happen to you if you have a Fong guide. That was the name of the tribe that was there. And about a month and a half, 2 months later, I hear that he went out on the river with a white man in a motorboat and died. And his body actually washed up about a couple miles beyond that fork where we were. So I don't know whether believing in that kind of silly folklore may have kept me alive or not. But
it doesn't really matter because you've sort of adopted this interesting position on superstition, I think. For a man of science, you're pretty good about your weird superstitions.
Well, they're funny superstitions. I have things like I have lucky numbers. So when I use a certain number of clamps in the operating room, I always like them to be divisible by certain numbers. It's just weird things like that. And
No. Don't sell that short.
Yeah.
Go ahead. It has to be divisible by three.
It has to be divisible by three.
Okay. So anytime you're putting clamps in someone's head, right, on the scalp, They have to be, and the number of clamps have to be divisible by 3. Why divisible by 3?
Well, it turns out that 3 is a very good number. You put rubber bands around them to hold them together. So 3 is a very good number. And I just got in this habit. And then after a while, I got superstitious. So if I saw like there was 1 left over or 2 left over, I changed the number. And I passed this on. I said, you know, always make sure the number, when I was working with my residents, always make sure the number is divisible by 3.
Now, did they say, oh, sage doctor mentor, why should we do a clamp, the clamps that are divisible by 3, a number divisible by 3? Did they ask you?
Yeah, and eventually I said, look, it's just I'm superstitious. I like 3, and
do me a favor and do it by 3.
And one of the stories I tell in the book is, one day, one of my patients, very unusual, developed a scalp infection, which was really unusual. And later, the resident came back and said to me, you know, I got something I have to confess to you. And I said, what? And he said, I just got so tired of you and your superstition of 3 clamps that when you weren't looking, I took one of them off the scalp so the number wouldn't be divisible by 3. And I said, You have no right to play around with my superstition.
Right. Who are you to mess with my weirdness?
Well, you know, I tell a story in the book about a funny, I was on my way to work to start in the morning, and there was a rabbit. I live out in Tucson, and there are jackrabbits sometimes running across the road, get run over. And so there's this one rabbit by the side of the road, and these two buzzards that were just eating it. And, you know, that's the kind of thing you notice. And I drove to work, and I'm getting ready for my first patient, going to the operating room, and I'm saying hello to him and his family and saying, you know, I'll meet you in the operating room in a minute. And the wife bends over as he's getting wheeled out, and she gives him a kiss, and she says, don't you worry, my little bunny. Everything will be fine.
And right after you've seen a rabbit picked apart by vultures.
Right. And all I'm telling you, the hair on the back of my neck just stood up when she said that word bunny. And I went out to the front desk, and fortunately it was a nurse I knew very well, and I said, look, don't ask me any questions. Just do me a favor. Take this guy and move him on the schedule to later in the day. I'm just kind of nervous about something. Just go ahead and humor me. And so we moved him later. Another patient went first. And while he was waiting, he had a massive heart attack. And had he gone into the operating room, he would have had that heart attack right in the middle of my doing brain surgery on him, and he probably would have died. And instead, here he was in the anesthesia unit, ready. He went right up to the coronary care unit, did very well. I operated on him 8 weeks later, but I can't help but thinking somehow that connection of the word bunny and that image somehow made my hair stand up, and I just sort of listened to it and said, I've got this funny feeling in my gut. Something's not right.
So I'm going to ask you something which I know you can't answer, but at least you can offer a thought on, is why do you think that's true?
Yeah, well, what I say, you know, Ian, is it's sort of like if I go for a hike and I'm walking along and I see mountains and I see trees and I see the view, and then behind me is a great photographer like Ansel Adams, and he's looking at the same things that I am. But he takes these beautiful, lovely, magical pictures with all of the beauty and the art and the majesty in them. And we were looking at the same thing, but he saw something completely different and much more eloquent. And I think the universe is really trying to speak to us in different ways. And most of the time we walk around pretty deaf to it. And sometimes the way we hear it is just these funny things like intuition and gut feelings and, sometimes we write them off, and sometimes we listen to them, and sometimes it's really the universe really trying to say, hey, I got a message for you.
Well, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a position I don't have. So, I mean,
okay.
I concur with you because I believe very much in the still small voice, and my wife and I have a policy that whenever we feel something should be done, even though it seems weird, we promise never to tease or criticize the other one for doing it. So if she gets in the car and she says, I need to go check the gas, she just gets out of the car, she goes back into the house and checks the gas. 9 times out of 10, 99 times out of 100 perhaps, it won't turn into anything. But we just have a policy, a sort of an orthopraxis of just doing it that way. And we're always surprised in the number of times when something pops up where it was just a voice, it was just an intuition that said, do this, check on this, call this person, find out X, and that it really turns into something. But that having been said, why could not it be, in the case of, say, an artist who's following behind you on the trail, that it just happens to be kind of the unique composition of their brain? Nothing ethereal about it. It's just that their brain just got, you know, constructed with a higher amount of matter in this part of the brain. You know all about the brain, and he's got more, you know, his the artistic side of his brain is more developed than the rational side of his brain, and that's why he sees colors and trees and everything differently than somebody that's walking on the trail before him.
Well, first, I admire the rule that your wife and you've come up with. Sounds very respectful. But I think in a lot of ways it is you're touching on a good point, and that is that part of our brains are we're not using them. They're atrophied. We've turned them off. We spend a lot of time thinking about science and thinking about rationale and rational thinking. And in a way, we've sort of downplayed the emotional, intuitive gut feeling that we have about things. How many times have we thought about somebody and then all of a sudden the phone rings or suddenly an email appears or suddenly we run into them? And sure, we can write that off as coincidence and synchronicity, or we can say maybe the feeling that we had actually made things happen.
Very true. But you, especially as somebody who is a neurosurgeon, you know about the intricacies of the brain. So we're, if you pardon the verb choice here, we're going to pick at that coming up after this break. I want to ask more about that. And I want to ask Dr. Alan Hamilton about his unique ability to see whether or not someone's going to survive or not, whether somebody will live. If he had a superpower besides being a super surgeon, this might be it. You're going to want to hear about it next. The Scalpel and the Soul is the name of the book, and our conversation continues on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So we're talking with Dr. Alan Hamilton about his experiences as a neurosurgeon. The book is The Scalpel and the Soul. It's out on paperback. It's just something you'd absolutely want to read. And one of the aspects of that story that grabbed me right away is Dr. Hamilton is going through his life are these times when he sees live people who might soon be dead people. I guess would be the way to describe it. Talk about this ability that you fear you have. I mean, I don't get the feeling you're entirely comfortable with it.
Well, you're right. I'm not. And it first came up, I was working as an assistant to a veterinary surgeon. That's how I learned that I was interested in surgery. And in a lot of vet practices, you put animals to sleep. And one of my jobs was to hold the animals while they gave the injection. So I'd literally be holding them in my arms as they died. And I would see this funny color come into them, sort of a almost like a candlelight color, like a yellow waxy color that would come into their face as they took their last breath. And I didn't think anything about it until I was much later in life in medical school. And we'd be walking around in the ICU, and periodically I'd see somebody with this same kind of color. And I'd go, uh-oh, I've seen that before. Now, it's not like I walk around, you know, in the elevator and say, okay, this person's going to die. It's not like that. But every once in a while, I'll see somebody and I'll see that color coming into them and I'll go, this person's in real trouble. And if they get better, that color goes away. But it means there's something terrible and they're very close to passing over.
Yeah, but, you know, even just passing a neighbor on the sidewalk, you've seen this color.
Yeah, I never talked. I was so uncomfortable about it. The only person I ever talked to it about was my wife. And I'd come home at night and I'd say, oh, you know, I've got a patient who's not doing well and they've got that funny color. And we talk about it. And then one day I'm passing my next door neighbor on the street, who's the patriarch of the family. And I kind of go, saying hello as I'm walking my dog, and I go, boy, that's funny. He's got that collar. And I came home to my wife, and I said, you know, is he okay? And she said, well, you know, I'll ask his daughter. She asked the next day, and she said, yeah, he's fine. He just went to see the doctor. Everything's fine. I go, oh, okay, well. And then 2 days later, there's an ambulance at the house, and he had been vomiting, coughing up blood, and had very extensive lung cancer. And, you know, those kinds of things sort of freak you out. They freak me out. And
how did his checkup doctor miss that?
Well, I don't know. I guess he didn't see the yellow light.
Yeah. But, I mean, isn't that kind of like a major thing? The idea of you got a lung full of cancer, that would pop up in your physical, don't you think?
He was a smoker, and I guess, you know, may have listened to his lungs and not done a chest x-ray or something like that. But, you know, I know that when we're visiting a relative in the hospital who's very ill in the ICU, and this happened once with my wife's dad, she just took me aside and said, does he have that collar? And I said, no, he doesn't. You know, he recovered.
Have you ever seen this in somebody not died? Somebody, you saw somebody yellow and waxy in your eyes, and then they ended up recovering and being just fine?
Oh, sure. I've seen it in people, like in the ICU, who are sort of not doing well, and then it goes away. It's not like I'm walking around and I see somebody in a restaurant or something like that. It's always in the context of walking around and seeing patients in the hospital or things in the clinic.
Except for that neighbor, which is kind of, you know, when you're passing somebody on a sidewalk, it's just some guy, you know, that you occasionally see barbecuing, and there suddenly you see him in a different light. I mean, I just think that's kind of amazing.
And I've seen it once in a while with a friend at a party where somebody will say something like, as you might imagine, oh, so-and-so's been seeing their doctor, and, you know, they're getting worked up and for some problem, or their cancer flared up. And I'll say to my wife, it's more than flared up. Something bad's going to happen.
Now, what do you think that is? I mean, you are, again, you're a scientist. You know the intricacies of the human brain. How do you think it's possible that you're able to have these, what, I don't know what you call them, visions, premonitions?
I think it's just kind of a gut premonition. You know, it's interesting that I still have the strongest feeling with animals. I have a ranch, and, you know, if an animal's sick or a calf's sick and it's not going to make it, I'll look at it and I'll come back in and say that, you know, like, we're going to lose that calf, I can tell. You know, I don't know. I don't know whether it's picking up on energy. You know, you read things like Carlos Castaneda's book where he talks about how sorcerers see people as energy and you know, that as luminous filaments of energy. And, you know, when I read those descriptions and he talks about how as people come close to dying, these filaments begin to unwind, it really reminded me a little bit of this sense of this diffuse light that's escaping from these people that I sometimes see.
Is it possible that you can still pick up these, I guess they would be changes in somebody's aura, only in person, or can you see it in a photograph?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I have to be right there next to them, and I can't see it in pictures or anything. I know there are people who can. But it's not for me. I have to be near the animal or near the human being. And again, it isn't like 100%, you know, it's
sure.
If I don't see it, it doesn't mean they're not going to die. It's just when I do see it, it really, gives me pause. And more than once I've said to the resident, go down and get a CAT scan on that person. Something's wrong.
Well, I mean, and I don't think the criterion should be perfection. I mean, you right? I mean, we don't. If somebody once said to me, if you had the ability, if you thought you had the ability to read something that was printed inside of a file, inside of a locked file cabinet, and 49 out of 50 times you were wrong, that 50th time is still so freakingly amazing that, you know, that you would be able to read something that was on a file that you couldn't. It was beyond guessing, the statistical guessing, that, you know, even if you're wrong more often than you're right, it's still an amazing gift. Have you ever considered putting it up to, if you, you know, think of it this way, sort of peer review, ever putting yourself up to a test in a medical school just to see whether the number of patients that you walk past in a day, and then you could say this one, and follow whether or not what percentage you would be right?
I've never done that, and it doesn't work like that. It'll be, it's usually a patient that I know or I'm taking care of. And as I say, more than once, it sort of has led me to think that something was wrong and go ahead and order some more tests. But it isn't the sort of thing where, you know, you could say, let's put it to a test, because, you know, I might not see somebody for 2 or 3 or 4 months or a year until I see that color. But when I see it, it means something, you know, is happening to them, I guess, energetically. I don't know. But I've always been sort of embarrassed. And the only thing I do about it is say, we've got to do, you know, let's do something. Something's wrong right here. And I don't really give my residents much of an explanation other than when the little hairs on the back of your neck stand up, you better listen to them.
Well, and these are just some of the interesting experiences that Dr. Alan Hamilton has had. The book is The Scalpel and the Soul. Were the hairs on the back of your neck standing up when you were around that poor boy that had gotten burned over a large percentage of his body and had received a transplant of skin from his father?
Well, what happened with this boy, he was close to dying, and his father, who was very young, died suddenly of a heart attack in his 40s. And it may be related to the stress. And the boy had been in a coma and was dying, and the mother said at the last minute, do you think there'd be any use to grafting the skin from his father onto him? And we said, you know, it's a last-ditch effort. Let's go ahead and do it.
But that's because his body had rejected. How many skin grafts had this poor, burned boy's body rejected before his father died suddenly?
5 or 6. And he was rejecting them faster and faster and more violently and vehemently than each one. So
what happens when that happens? When the skin graft is rejected by the body, how does that happen?
Well, it gets infected, and the body starts sloughing it off because the skin isn't a perfect match genetically for the patient's own skin. But if you don't cover them up, they're going to die literally from losing so much moisture. So what we do is we graft on the skin, and it keeps them covered until we can start to harvest their own grafts. In this case, he was dying, and he was in a coma. I'd never talked to him. He'd been on a ventilator the whole time I took care of him. And then we grafted his dad's skin onto him, and it was about 15 hours of surgery, and I was exhausted, and I went to sleep. And then the nurse came knocking on the door and said the boy was waking up. I said, that's impossible. I thought something was wrong with the vent, and I run in. And sure,
Why would that be impossible?
I had never seen him. He had been unconscious and in a coma the entire time. I had taken care of him for months.
Really? For months, and he never said anything?
Not a word. Never opened his eyes, nothing. So
wow.
I ran in thinking something was wrong with his ventilation, and sure enough, his eyes are open, and even though his hands are bandaged, he's trying to pull his breathing tube out. So I took it out, and the very first words out of his mouth were, what's happened to my father? And I was an intern, and I made a mistake. I didn't know any better. I just didn't want him, the first words he heard from me, to be about his dad. So I said, he's fine. I lied to him.
Oh.
And then the boy said, are you sure? And I said, yes, why? And he says, well, why is my father standing at the end of the bed smiling at me but not saying anything? And I just, you know, whipped around and I looked at the end of the bed, and, of course, it was empty.
Are you the only one in the room? The nurses are there with you?
There was a nurse there with me. And we both, then it, all of a sudden it hit me, and I turned back to him and I said, I have something terrible to tell you. And that is that your dad passed away. And the boy said, well, that must be his ghost that's smiling at me. And he waved, and the boy went on to make an absolutely miraculous recovery. And I lost track of him for 10 years while I was training as a surgeon. On the very last day, I'm going up to hand my B-print and leave. I get on the elevator, and there's a woman there I recognize. Next to her standing about a teenage burn victim. And I realized that's the mother, and this is the boy that I took care of a decade ago. And he's alive, and he's well, and he's finishing high school. And I thought, this can't be a coincidence that he's there. It must be the universe sort of telling me, don't you try and sweep this under the rug. Don't you try and forget what you saw.
Right. And the mother told you that the boy had been thriving, and that here was a kid who had rejected, whose body had rejected 5 or 6 skin grafts and was in a coma the whole time. And ever since he got his father's skin, he not only bounced back, but he was doing great.
And he ended up being one of the first human beings in the world who actually had skin grown in culture dishes, because he had survived long enough with his father's graft that could actually grow his skin in a culture dish into sheets, then put it on him. And if it hadn't been for his father, he never would have been able to be that miracle kid who survived because of those new grafts.
And the only skin he had left from being burned was under his armpits and on his genitals.
Right. Those are usually the last two places, if you're going to get spared, those are the last two places that there'll be patches of skin where we can actually harvest normal skin cells and grow them.
Now, I imagine still the boy had plenty of evidence of all of that massive burning that had experienced.
Oh, yeah.
But at least his body now was kind of a closed biological system and not subject to all the infections and all the other things that could have happened.
And he needed a lot of revision surgery down the road, obviously, because of all the scar tissue. But he would never have survived if it hadn't been for this kind of miracle that took place because of his father's skin.
Been thinking about that kid all day long. Ever since I read that story, I've just been thinking about him. And I hope he came out fine, and I know that it's fine would be relative to never having been through a massive burning like that. But then that's just, you know, of the many things you've experienced as a surgeon over the years, that's probably still wouldn't be the number one most unusual, would you say?
I wouldn't say, but, you know, again, as we were talking earlier, they start to pile up. And even as a scientist, you can't say, look, I'm going to just write this off as something wacky, crazy. Start to pile up like evidence in a scientific study. So, yes, it's not the most strange, but it was one of the ones that definitely sort of
started pushing me
over the threshold a little bit.
Did you talk to other surgeons about patients who claim to see either their donors or other family members who are coming to get them or be with them in their final minutes?
You know, we do talk about it, but then we sort of brush it under the carpet. It's a very funny thing. It makes us very uncomfortable because we're used to everything being something we can explain, something that's logical, something that's scientific. And then we'll have this where a patient will say, you know, for example, if a patient comes in and says, I feel like I'm going to die, you better take that very seriously, because 9 times out of 10, they're right. Something bad is going to happen and they're going to die.
Right.
If they say, I had a dream, I had a patient where he had a dream that his son had come to see him, and I didn't realize he even had a son. And then later he tells me the story. His son had died as a pilot. He had been shot down over Vietnam. And had died, and his son had come in a dream to tell him that they would be together. And I went back to the lab, the chart. I looked at his numbers and said, "There's nothing wrong with him. There's nothing wrong with him." And then that very same day, he died.
Was that the Merchant Marine?
Mm-hmm. That's Mr. Holt. That was a patient who had a heart attack and a near death experience.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Right.
The guy who had. The Merchant Marine who had survived the Nazi submarine attack in World War II, been only one of a few of a couple dozen of the guys on his boat. I thought that was such an interesting way that he talked about it, because the rule at the time in World War II was you didn't slow down for the torpedoed victims, because that's just what the Nazis wanted you to do, to slow down and try to help the victims. And if you help the poor guys that were left in the water, then they would just torpedo more boats that slowed down. So it was full speed ahead, even if it meant leaving your buddies behind to drown. And he had gotten left behind after a Merchant Marine attack. How had he survived? What had happened? He had been floating out in the water. How did he live through that?
Floating out in the water, he was picked up by a convoy that was coming behind his convoy. So he was still in the water. And he was... obviously, a number of his fellow Merchant Marines had died in the boat being torpedoed and so on. And he had been haunted by this. And I remember when he had a heart attack and he almost died. He had a near-death experience. And he came back and he told me, he said, it was like the sense of peace that came over him. He said, it was like when I came home from the war and I knew I was finally safe and with everybody that I loved, only 100 times magnified. And he and I talked about it quite some time, and he said it really gave him a sense of peace to know that his fellow brothers, merchant marines who had died in the water, in the cold, in the dark, in the North Atlantic, that was what was waiting for them, was this incredible sense of peace and beauty and warmth as they passed over.
Well, and I want you to actually tell the rest of the story of how that guy died, that merchant marine, and what he said to you just before he passed. Then we'll talk about the soul. Where is the soul? What is it that a neurosurgeon thinks of when he thinks of the soul? Where does he see it? Where is it connected in our bodies? Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Dr. Alan Hamilton, let's start where we left off, and that's the gentleman who had been a merchant marine who had always remembered the guys that were there in the water that didn't get saved the night that his convoy was torpedoed by Nazis. And talk about his last few minutes of life. I thought it was really interesting.
Well, in the book, his name is Mr. Holt, and I had taken care of him, and he had shared a lot about his experiences in the war with me. One day I came into his room, and as we were talking earlier, I saw this light, and I knew something was up, and I ordered a lot of tests and said, let's get this guy back to the ICU. And he had an inkling that something was coming, and I was hustling around, and I said, no, something is happening, and it looks like you're having a heart attack. And he just basically said, you know, don't worry, kid, you can't stop to pick up stragglers. It's full steam ahead, which was what the orders were for those convoys. And he just reminded me, you know, that he wasn't afraid of dying. He had been through near-death experience, and he wasn't afraid of dying, and he really knew what was waiting on the other side, and it was his time to go, and I couldn't stop. I just wasn't going to be able to save him.
And that speaks to that idea that somehow, if you don't want to live, and you know it's your time, there's nothing to stop you. I mean, there's lots of people that survive circumstances because of their desire to survive the circumstance. But when he looked at you and he said, you know, remember, kid, you know, full steam ahead, don't stop for stragglers. He was also giving you permission to let him die.
We see this all the time. It's one of the things that I have a hard time when I'm arguing with doctors about spirituality and taking a holistic approach to surgery. We see patients all the time who we think are going to die, and they'll say something like, I got to make it till my son gets back from Iraq. And you look and you think to yourself, there's no way they're not going to make it a couple of weeks. Their son doesn't come back for 6 months, but they make it. And the power of positive emotion is enormous. And the impact it has, if we look at things like voodoo, and you come from a culture where you believe in voodoo, and I saw this in Africa a lot, you can take perfectly healthy people, and if they believe that a curse has been put on them, they will go on and die within 3 or 4 days, and there's nothing that medicine can do to stop it. And if they're told in the middle of this that the curse has been lifted, they recover. And it seems to me we are always willing to talk about how stress kills, how anxiety kills, but how your beliefs can kill you. But we spend much less time talking about how your beliefs can cure you, how they can help you and improve the quality of your life and your recovery, because they have enormous impact on recovery.
But we do in a way, because I take your point wholeheartedly, but there's also the medical science version of voodoo, and that's the placebo effect.
Enormous positive proof of what the power of the human mind. Here we spend billions of dollars every year in all of these pharmaceutical research projects to try and take care of this placebo effect. Isidore Rosenfeld talked about a patient of his that was a cardiac patient, and they were doing what's called a double-blind randomized crossover trial, which is at some point in the study you switch from one medication to the placebo or from placebo to the medication. And his patient got the drug and was doing great. His exercise stress test got better. He had no angina, and everything was going great, and they broke the code. And then he found out that this guy had been only receiving placebo. And he had this ethical dilemma because the guy's stress tests were better. The guy was taking less medication. He was having less problems with his heart. He was enjoying his grandchildren in the playground. What was he going to do? Tell him, hey, all of this was in your head. And, you know, this was, it wasn't real. But in a lot of ways, it was. And I think placebo is a very important proof of how much our belief systems and our positive emotional input can change the course of an illness or the impact of on recovery.
But that is its own kind of voodoo in the power of suggestion that this will hurt you or this will kill you. People will begin to mimic that suggestion, and they will embody those the symptoms as they imagine them.
But we use that every day in medicine. You know, I always point out, why do we wear white coats? Well, years ago, it was important because it showed us when we were contaminated with fluid and so on. But we wear white coats now mostly because that's part of our garb. That's part of our authority. That's part of the symbolism of our profession. But it also has a tremendous impact on the patient when you say, you know, I'm talking to you, and I think that we can put together a regimen that's going to fix this problem or make you feel better. And that white coat carries a lot of emotional and symbolic power with it, with all of us.
Well, and it's not just the color of cleanliness, right? I mean, it's also the symbol of the lab. It's the lab coat. It's the belief that somehow there's a magical place where you can go to fix something. You can go figure something out in the lab.
Well, and the operating theater. I always think it's kind of that old fashioned term, the operating theater. You know, it's a place of drama. You go there and you get out of your regular street clothes and you take on this special uniform and you wear masks and then you go through this. And I always feel like that's how an operating room should feel to surgeons. It should feel like a place of drama. It should, you know, I always think about how time stands still when I'm in the operating room, that hours and hours go by and you're completely lost in this flow state while you're operating. So, yeah, there is a lot of symbolism behind it and a lot of power of suggestion behind it.
Now, the work that you do on brains, I know, you know, probably a lot of the time it may seem somewhat routine. You're an accomplished surgeon at that level. But are there times even when you're still astounded by the activity of the brain or what you see when you go into somebody's head, literally?
Well, I think first is you look at this organ that is kind of a cream color with a lot of vessels on it, kind of soft and mushy. And, you know, when you first look at it, and every time you operate and you look at it, you remind yourself, my goodness, this, we're inside the skull. We're inside this temple of where this human being lives. And here's this incredible organ that really doesn't look exceptional, but it is exceptional. I was thinking about a perfect example, which is people can have a small stroke on the left side of the brain that can leave them with a difficulty or inability to speak. But they still can sing with the right side of the brain. And you would think in your mind, well, speech is similar to song, but it isn't. The brain understands these as two completely different functions. And one is logical, and the other is intuitive. And it's almost like lyrics and music going together. And so the brain is organized in ways that are amazing and in some ways suggest a profound intelligence. intelligent design.
You use those words carefully. Tell me, as you see that beyond evolution, do you see that as when you say intelligent design, you mean that in the same way that others do, that we were made exactly like this from the very beginning?
You're putting me on the spot here.
But you use the words intelligent design, and those are code. Those are code words.
This is an incredible organ that we have. It's not only that we are the recipients of millions of years of incredible evolution, but this organ is capable of evolving in our own lifetime. This organ changes from its experiences. It adds to its anatomy. It is literally able to morph into different situations and program itself. And it gives us capabilities that of intuition and spirituality and logic and art and creativity and analysis. And they're all mixed together in a way that is so far beyond what we would normally think of, for example, something like a computer. This is put together with a sense of artistry and a sense of creativity that really makes you wonder about that phrase from the Bible that, you know, that we were made in God's image. There's something divine. And when I look at the design of the brain and I look at how the pieces fit together, there is something majestic and artistic about it.
Then where is the soul?
You know, I don't know where the soul is, but I can tell you one patient of mine who underwent an unusual procedure where she was on we had to operate on a difficult blood vessel, and for doing that, we had to put on a cardiac pump and cool her body down, and then eventually just stop her heart and stop the pump so there was no blood, no oxygen flowing. And obviously, we were operating directly on the brain, so I had electrodes on the surface of the brain. There was no electrical activity. She was brain dead. We had 20 minutes to fix this vessel. We fixed it. We got it done under the wire. Everybody relaxed. There was a lot of conversation going on in the OR, and one of the nurses told us over the weekend she got engaged. You know, people were chit-chatting. We got the pump going. Patient made a beautiful recovery. I went to see her in the ICU post-operatively, and I'm talking to her and telling her how everything went very well. And she says, you know, there's this really interesting conversation that I remember. And I said, what do you mean you remember conversation? Well, she said, I remember something about somebody getting married, and they went to this restaurant, and they got their engagement ring at this particular store. And all of these were details that the nurse had told us while her heart was stopped, and there was no oxygen flowing and no electrical activity. Now, I know as a scientist, there's no way that this brain can make memories. Everything I know about the brain is it has to have electrical activity in order to make a memory. And she had no electrical activity during this procedure. And yet, those memories were made somewhere. And they came back into her brain after electrical activity returned to her brain. And I suppose that this is about as close as I'll get to the holy grail of the soul in this life as a neurosurgeon. But I don't have an explanation for this other than some kind of consciousness can exist separate from the activity of the brain itself.
I've heard it said that, you know, that the genetic composition of the material that leads to the development of the brain is in every cell, even if that cell eventually becomes a foot or becomes a kneecap, it still contains the same genetic information that would allow it to, if it had been positioned differently in the body and had been fired differently than it would if it had been turned into a brain cell. Is that true?
Absolutely. And when we start off, the cells they migrate. And if a cell had migrated to the part that was going to become the central nervous system, it'll become brain tissue. And if it migrates to another area that's, you know, going to be gut or muscle or bone, it'll turn into that. But at the beginning, they're pluripotential, which is one of the reasons people are getting so excited about stem cells, because these are primitive cells that have the ability to do a lot of these things where they become other tissues.
Right. So that makes me think, though, in terms of how this woman heard this material. and how she experienced this material is that perhaps it was, as you point out earlier, you know, the brain is an amazing thing. You turn off part of that brain and the other parts of the brain can turn on and attempt to compensate. Well, maybe if we looked at that a little bit more holistically, we can say with the body as a whole organ, if you turn off the brain, that other cells in the body will activate their brainness and begin to compensate for the brain cells that are not firing. What do you think?
I think it's an interesting idea that this kind of primitive memory, if you will, almost at a cellular level. I think it's interesting also that when people have near-death experiences, they're almost always preceded by an out-of-body experience first, that they have this sense of drifting out of their body and seeing themselves. And I've always wondered, why is that? And of course, on an intuitive level, we say, oh, well, you're dying and you're leaving your body behind. And yet, in some ways, the body that they're leaving behind is also their brain. And so you wonder, you know, if this part isn't just the leaving the whole cellular memory behind in a way, too.
So where could the soul be in your experience as a neurosurgeon? If
well,
it's not, where you know for sure?
And for one of this experience and this a couple of others, I think it's a consciousness that exists completely separate from the electrical activity of our brain. I think it is able to exist completely separate from brain activity, wherever that is.
Okay. All right. Well, then let's do the scientific thing and say, what are the likely suspects? So if it's electrical activity outside of the body, then could it be merely electrical activity that exists in our same space, our same physical space, but on a different plane?
I'm sure that's, you know, Ian, I'm sure that's one explanation. I always think that we're so naive some ways that we are always, you know, I always think back, what would the Greeks think if they came now in 2009 and they'd go, all these things we attributed to the gods, you have explanations for. You know, in 2,000 years, somebody's going to come back and we're going to look at these things and say we had no explanation for where the soul was worked or how intuition worked or how, you know, telekinetic presence worked. And you know, science is going to say, no, we explained all of that, you know. And right now we're looking at it going, well, we had no way of knowing. We had no way of explaining it. I just think there's so many energetic forms that we don't understand yet.
You know, I was actually reminded of that today. I was preaching today, so I'm reading the Bible text for this particular day in the lectionary, and it's the parable that Jesus tells about what the kingdom of God is like, and that it's like seeding a field. And they said, you know, that the farmer will seed the field, and then first the stalk comes up, then the head, and then the grain in the head. And that the line said in there, though the farmer, you know, the farmer sleeps night and day, whatever, and knows not how this happens. And I thought that was so interesting because we know now how it happens. We know how these things molecularly develop. We have so much science on how plants grow. But at the time, they didn't have that kind of science, and it looked kind of magical, even though the farmer didn't know how it happened. He just knew he planted it and it grew. And I actually was thinking about that. All the things that to this day we don't know how they work, that someday we will know, and it we'll be able to have a better idea of just how these particular experiences we have that seems so beyond our own ability to explain it, that someday somebody else will, and they'll look back on us and go, oh, that's so interesting. How long ago before they understood how the science of the soul, for example, we'll get back to this, the scalpel and the soul, it's the experiences of Dr. Alan Hamilton. All right, I want to ask about The Exorcist, and we'll get into that before we get to your phone calls coming up next hour. Highly recommend this book. It's all about experiences with surgery, the supernatural, and the healing power of hope. We'll talk a little bit more about that, too, before our time runs out. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Ponet. Dr. Alan Hamilton, the author of The Scalpel and the Soul, So, you know, I guess whenever we're talking about good experiences and something that we would associate as being connected to the divine, like the soul, or like you told the story about Thomas, the boy that had had the many skin grafts that had all been rejected until he had the skin graft from his father who had died while he was in a coma, and the skin graft had helped save the boy's life. And then he, right there in front of witnesses, said his father was standing there waving to him at the end of the bed. You know, whenever we talk about the good experiences, the question comes up then, well, what about bad experiences? So where are you if there are these types of angels or guiding spirits, are there malevolent forces as well? Dr. Hamilton?
You know, malevolent, I guess, is dependent on your definition. I had a personal experience. I was taking care of a boy I'd become very fond of who had a malignant brain tumor, brain cancer. And he was close to dying, and I decided to take a couple of days off just to be there because I wanted to see him through to the end. And he passed away, and I guess I took it pretty hard. And the next morning, I had taken some days off, so I was just having a cup of coffee when suddenly I just felt like this blind, shearing pain going through my back. And I fell to the floor, and I just felt like I was paralyzed. I thought at the time I had popped a disc or something in my back, and I just couldn't move. And I was lying there, and eventually I kept thinking, well, what's going to happen to me? And there was a knock at the door, and an old friend of mine came through the door. I thought it was going to be UPS or something, and I was going to ask him to go for help. And instead, it's this friend of mine from the medical school who's a Navajo medical student. And I said, oh, I'm so glad you're here. And he was leaning over me. He says, I'm going to go get help. I thought he was going to get a truck or an ambulance or something. And
right,
he's gone. And 2 hours later, he comes back with this obvious elderly gentleman with long silver hair who's a Navajo medicine man. And that's who he brings back to the house.
Now, you're not still lying on the floor all this time.
I'm still lying on the floor. I thought I was paralyzed. I was afraid to move.
And okay, you've been laying there for 2 hours. The guy left you there for 2 hours lying on the floor.
I thought he was just going outside. and my wife comes through the door, and he's there with this medicine man who only speaks Navajo. He's having to translate for me. And the medicine man says, get up. And I said, oh, I can't move. I can't move. And he said, no. Puts his chair up and says, no, you'll be able to get up. And I somehow he gives me his hand, and I felt this incredible warmth coming through his hand. And I somehow get up, and I sit down, and he says, you have to have your family sitting on the couch facing you. And then he says, take off your shirt. And I'm sitting on his chair, and we had a little fireplace, and he put some herbs in there, and there's sweet smelling sage and stuff. And he starts behind me, and I can feel him fanning me with a feather fan. And then all of a sudden, I don't know how to explain this, but I felt as if he had moved somehow inside of me. I felt this incredible warmth from him that just felt like pure love was inside of me. And I had not mentioned a word about this young boy to anybody. And he suddenly says, you're holding on to the spirit of someone who wants to pass over to the other side, and you're holding on very tightly to them. And this pain that you're experiencing is them kicking to try and get loose because you won't let go of them. And you have to give them permission to leave and permission to pass over. And then through my friend who was a translator, he said, I will take you through the ceremony to let them depart. And we went through that, and all of a sudden, in a matter of a half an hour, all the pain was gone from my body. I had this profuse sweating. I remember my pants were just soaked. My waistband and my pants were just soaked with sweat. And I just felt this pain disappearing. And, I didn't know what to do. I'd never been around a medicine man before. I said, what do I, you know, do I pay him? Does he have a silly, you know, insurance program or something? And he said, no, just, it's just a tradition to make dinner. And I said, I looked at the clock, and the But it was 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. And I said, you know, it's getting pretty late. My kids, and he said, well, all I know is grandfather came to see you when you needed him. So I said, well, what do I do? And he says, well, you need to make the meal for him. And I said, I don't know how to really make very much except spaghetti and meatballs. And he said, that'll be fine. So there we were about midnight sitting around the table with my whole family and my friend and a Native American medicine man having spaghetti and meatballs.
Totally love that. And that was fine. That was just fact that you made it was the important part,
well,
regardless.
That was my way of showing thanks for what his healing ceremony. And, you know, I'm sort of schizophrenic when I'm going through this, because on the one hand, I'm thinking as a neurosurgeon, I'm going, oh, I've herniated a disc and I've got pressure up against my nerve roots and I've got to be careful.
Right.
And then
all
of a sudden I'm feeling this completely different experience that I'm at a total loss to explain, other than I felt it personally. I don't know how else to put it.
Why do you think you held on to the spirit of that boy, or why do you think that child who died was more inclined to be wrapped around you than any of the other patients you had had? Why had that experience not happened before, do you think?
I think there's a certain amount of distance that's important. I mean, you know, there's a reason they don't let you operate on your family members. And I think sometimes we get so close to people, and I think in this particular case, because it was a child and he reminded me so much of my own children and so on, I got very, very involved emotionally with him. And it was very difficult for me to let him go. And I think in a lot of ways that just ended up manifesting itself physically in me. And I think we all have these experiences in one way or another where what's going on emotionally takes on a somatic, a bodily representation. In this case, it was this excruciating, horrible, paralyzing, lightning-like pain that went through my body.
Yeah, I don't know why, but many times during the course of reading The Scalpel and the Soul, I was reminded of a boy I went to high school with. He was a couple of years ahead of me. I lived not far from a main kind of, I guess it would be sort of a county highway that ran through my hometown and my county. And the one morning I woke up and there was a hubcap in my tree. And I thought it was from a friend, and I thought it was kind of a gag. He found something in the street, threw it up in the tree in front of my house. And I came to find out that actually during the night, there had been a horrible car accident about 200 yards away on this county road near my house. And that hubcap had come flying off of the car of a kid that I was going to school with. It was a couple of years ahead of me, as he had racked the car around a light pole. And the power of was so fascinating, it sent that flying like a frisbee into my tree.
Wow.
Long way away. So that was how the day started, and I found out that this boy had been had worried about him. And the rest of the story is that he had been taken down to the emergency room, and it was a miracle that he had even survived that far. And he was down with the highly trained ER nurses and doctors that were fighting to save his life, even though the car had almost literally been split in half by the light pole. He was being treated by the most experienced ER nurse, who didn't know until halfway through the procedure that the boy that she was fighting to save was her son.
Oh, my goodness.
And she didn't know it until they had pulled the wallet out of his pants, because he was unrecognizable, and they didn't pull her off. And she refused to leave. They tried everything they could do to save the kid, and he died. But I always wondered what that would be like if I were her. Would I want somebody else to step in? Would I feel like I had to stay in and fight because that was my son? That would be a decision I would wrestle with as a medical professional, I think, for the rest of my life.
I had a similar case where I didn't know this at the time. Somebody had asked me, because of a problem with the operating room schedule, if I could go down and take care of a gunshot wound to the head. And I went downstairs, and you know, they'd gotten the case pretty much prepared for me, so a lot of the drapes were on, and I went to work, and the operation went very well. I thought we had an artery had been ripped apart, and we had to repair it. And at the end of the case, I was kind of feeling really upbeat that we had done such a good job, and everybody in the room was kind of subdued. And I finally said to the head nurse, what's going on? We did such a great job. The team just did such a great job. And they said, we didn't want to tell you to the end of this case, but this is the son of one of your best friends. And, I just realized, this was a kid I knew, and I had been at my house, and so on and so forth. And, I don't know that I could have done it at the time. And I know that because afterwards there were a number of complications from stroke from this vessel and so on, I remembered feeling very, very, very guilty. And very confused and upset because I wanted so much to make absolutely everything positive happen. So I think sometimes you can get so close, so involved, that your judgment is off. You just can't make the clear-headed decisions, when it's somebody that you love and you care about.
Well, at the same time, if I were this the head ER nurse that had treated this kid I went to school with, I might feel like I know I'm the best one there. I know that there's a reason why I'm the top ER nurse, and that I wouldn't want anybody else even to be 2% less good at the job than I am working on my son. I don't know. Like I said, the case sort of haunts me, and I'll never have a resolution to that, but I think about it from time to time. And I liked how you reflected on something else. Since we brought up the divine earlier in the hour, talking about the book, The Scalpel and the Soul, I spent two rotations as a hospital chaplain.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I was really... It was an interesting experience going through as an intern once in seminary and then did one more rotation after having graduated seminary, that there were some doctors that were very receptive to the presence of the chaplain, and others that seemed to resent the chaplain being there. And that there was almost sort of like almost a tolerance of the chaplain's presence, but not a happy tolerance. It's sort of like, almost like I might as well been sitting there with a bone through my nose, and shaking a skull at the patient. But other doctors embraced the idea that even if they weren't particularly religious, that the chaplain brought an aspect to the healing. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I think you're right. There is a lot of spectrum about how people feel about chaplains within medicine. I think it introduces the notion of spirituality from the ground up. And I think it allows for that conversation of how do we marshal our spiritual and emotional forces. What is spirituality? Spirituality is just this intuitive drive that we have to reach out for something greater and bigger than ourselves. And it can be however you want to define it. Your love of your family, your love of your faith, your love of the universe, your love of nature, however you want to. As somebody said, love is the easiest word used to describe spirituality. So I think chaplains are a gift. And as I moved along in my progression as a surgeon, I saw the chaplains there more and more for both of us, for both the patient and the physicians. And I can't tell you the number of times when something bad was going on and a patient wasn't doing well that I was able to ask a chaplain, could I just pull you over to talk for a moment, and or could we pray together? And it became a part of my life. I think one of the terrible things that's happened as hospitals have cut back and cut corners and cut costs is that the chaplaincy programs have often suffered.
Oh, yeah.
At the very time when medicine is sort of discovering that, hey, we've got to take in the entire patient, their spirit,
right,
and their physical body.
Just one more thing that ends up falling on the nurses.
Yeah,
without the chaplains.
And depriving them of the resource of having the chaplains to go to and to be able to say to the patients, would you like a chaplain? Because very often, when people face a physical illness, a severe illness or major surgery, that is the time they feel this most vulnerable period, and that's the time they feel this need to rally their spiritual resources. And very often, it may be a chaplain who isn't even of their faith, or they may not even have a religious faith, but the chaplain there is allowing that dialogue to take place.
My experience was actually in many cases that people wanted a chaplain outside of their own faith tradition because they could say things to that kind of chaplain that they couldn't say to their own, you know, traditional clergy, because they would be too embarrassed, and they'd want to maintain the doctrinal line, you know, that they grew up with, but staring at the ceiling tile, they wanted to say something different, and they wanted to experience something different, so they would often reach outside of their of what they had known in order to be able to express something without fear of judgment. I always thought that was interesting. I knew I often would be called into a room with somebody who was going to say something that they couldn't say to their own pastor for fear of judgment.
Right, what I've seen. A lot of times it's their own pastor in their own church. Not that a lot of people don't ask for their pastors to come and be there, but at the same time, sometimes they feel like there's all this history from the church and all of the social interactions there, and then that hospital chaplain is really just there for them.
Yeah, and similarly, there are times when, as a chaplain, I think it's a very different experience than those people who enjoy being sort of cloistered in the church, because I've always said, if you can't say it into the eyes of somebody who's dying, chances are it's not true.
Yeah, it's funny how that dying sort of levels the playing field of honesty.
Suddenly, all that bumper sticker theology that it was so handy before, it just seems really anemic.
Yeah, it's nuts and bolts theology when you get down to that level of, you know, we're trying to talk to people who are facing serious illness or death.
Well, and that there's a whole chapter on it, and I can't get you to encapsulate it easily, but I like what you were saying about how sometimes you feel like it's an advantage when you go into a room and the patient believes in the divine, that gives you an advantage as their doctor. Why?
Because you suddenly are sort of saying, you know what, not everything in this world is under our control, and we've sort of agreed together that we're going to appeal to all of the forces, that everything that we can ask to come to our aid is we're asking it humbly. And I think, you know, if you're the kind of surgeon who thinks that the only thing standing between you and that patient's death is just your skill, then you're probably pretty arrogant. And I'd much rather have the conversation of, we're in this together, and please, 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 can the universe send us as much aid and assistance and support as it can so we can get through this together.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, and I think there are some surgeons, and very likely the minority of surgeons, who don't like the presence of the chaplain in the room because it reminds them that there is a rival god to themselves.
Yes. There's competition.
There's competition for head deity in the room, and some surgeons just don't like that. But obviously, Dr. Alan Hamilton's different. The book is The Scalpel and the Soul, and we'll continue with the encounters with surgery, the supernatural, and the healing power of hope when we get to your questions and comments coming up next. And I highly recommend you pick up this book. It's in paperback now, and you can link up to that through our website at coasttocoastam.com. Well, let's get to the calls. In fact, let's start with the wild card line, because something may have changed, and let's go ahead and verify that. But if this ends up going to a dial tone, we know that the problem hasn't been fixed. Greg is in San Diego on Coast to Coast for Dr. Alan Hamilton. Greg?
Hey, how's it going, guys?
So far, so good. Go ahead.
Wanted to ask about if Dr. Hamilton believed that the soul might actually have weight to it. You know, some people say the body actually weighs less just the minute after the soul leaves the body.
The 21 grams theory.
Famous 21 grams.
Yeah, famous. Go ahead, Dr. Hamilton.
Well, you know, these experiments were done starting in the 19th century, and they very carefully weighed people on their deathbed. And at the moment of expiration, there was a change in the weight. I don't know if I really buy that. It would seem to me that very, very difficult to ascribe something like the soul to something that weighs 21 grams. But that's the historic story.
Well, you had, I mean, when the when the Indian shaman came, right, when the medicine man got that spirit to leave your body that you had been holding on to, I wonder if you weighed less.
I certainly felt like a weight had been taken off my shoulders.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting that we always use that expression?
I think it's interesting we use that expression. I think that the fact that we use colors, we say somebody's blue or yellow, for cowardice or green with envy, they all strike me as peculiar expressions, like the lifting a weight off your shoulders.
Right. And so, you know, did you see anything, or did you only feel it when the medicine man got your body to release that spirit?
The only way I can describe the feeling for me, the bodily sensation, was this sense of him, of this incredible, warm, loving presence moving into me. And I definitely had the feeling that it was introduced into me and then withdrawn. And I had the feeling of him somehow being at risk with me in as part of the healing process, and I always remember that as being very different from a lot of the medical models, that he was a partner in this process. He was in it with me, as opposed to sometimes the role that we take as physicians of just sort of being the spectator on the sideline.
Right. Martha is in Boise, Idaho, on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Alan Hamilton, the scalpel and the soul. Martha?
Hello, Alan. Hello, Dr. Hamilton.
Hi, Martha.
I've got a quick story and a quick question. At the age of 17, my son had a pineal gland brain tumor. And the doctors were very inexperienced, and they kept telling him that he could live a normal life, and all they had to do was put a shunt, you know, a faucet in his neck. And he went through a couple of shunts. First one failed. But the whole time he was going through this, the doctor said, "You'll be fine. You know, you can live with this." And Michael kept telling us that he knew he was going to die. And most of the family was, you know, wanted to think positive, and they were in denial, and they didn't want to believe what he was saying. But he had told us, he had told me several times that he knew he was dying because he had seen angels. They had come to him and taken him down a path, and they had shown him the spirit world. And I would ask him, you know, what did it look like? And he said it was so beautiful that there were no words to describe what it looked like. And the pineal tumor is, I believe it's also considered the third eye.
Yes, it's sometimes referred to as the third eye.
Why is that, Dr. Hamilton?
It was thought that the pineal gland was involved in a lot of issues about diurnal, about the sunlight and the changes in sunlight. And so it was as if it was seeing, even though it's deep within the brain, as if it was seeing the daylight pattern. So it was like a third eye.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead then, Martha. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. But the doctors were very inexperienced, and this tumor was growing at a very fast rate. And so he finally passed away. But I just wanted to ask him if children seem to be more spiritually connected than adults during their final hours or their final days.
Well, Martha, I think that's a very astute observation. I'm sorry to hear about Michael, and very often children have a premonition. I think it's just that children are so much more directly connected to their emotional and intuitive state. And I think as we get older and more educated, that we get farther and farther away, and we get separated in some ways from that whole, you know, that wholeness that children have. So I think in a lot of ways, Michael was probably more in touch than a lot of us at a more advanced age. I think the other thing that I'm interested about in Michael's experiences, it's so similar. When you look at these experiences of people who are getting ready to pass over or have had near-death experiences, there's similarities. The fact that it's never have I experienced with a patient that it was something tumultuous or turmoil or despairing or sad, but it was always a feeling of warmth and beauty and love and light. And I think it's telling us that that's what that first step into the next journey is like. And I think it's very reassuring in a way that it's so similar across cultures and across time, across history. I think it's telling us something very real.
Appreciate those thoughts, and also sorry about Michael's loss, but also because you were willing to share that with us. I know that's going to be helpful for other people. I will say, Dr. Hamilton, when I my first rotation I did as a chaplain intern was in pediatric oncology. And my feeling was at the time that the reason why children were more inclined to talk about mortality and or their experiences was because they don't lie as much.
Point well taken.
We get older, we lie a lot. We lie a lot to ourselves, to our family. Kids just lie less, I think. Let's get to Linda in California on Coast to Coast. Linda?
Ian, thank you for taking my call. And Dr. Hamilton, what a wonderful man. Let me give you a little bit about my background and why I feel this topic is just so, it really is impacting my heart. I'm a healthcare professional, worked in a hospital for 21 years, have had 3 major motor vehicle accidents. I'm a good driver. They weren't my fault, FYI. Wound up having to have spinal surgery. And your experience with holding on to that, I've heard in Chinese medicine that the liver is the seat of emotion, number one, and also as a woman of faith, I've heard it explained this way, which I found very easy to understand, you know, the difference. I want to know, what's the difference between the soul and the spirit? And I've heard it said this way, in that we are a spirit. We live in a physical body on this earth, call it our earth suit, and we possess a soul. And the soul is comprised of the mind, the intellect, the will, the emotions. And it's very, the soul and the spirit are so interconnected, is, and we're, you know, we're gas and solid and liquid. And once this biofrequency or the energy or the God consciousness that we have in us leaves this physical body, you know, in science, matter is neither created nor destroyed. Only God can do that. It just changes form. What are your thoughts? And thank you so much for taking my call.
Well, thank you, Linda. I think that first, this issue of body and spirit and soul is a sense of holistic approach. When we look at the brain, when we look at the sense of spirituality that's built into the brain, the sense of pleasure that we get from altruism, literally, or when we do good for others, we feel good. We have parts of our brain that people have referred to as the Dalai Lama neurons. These are neurons that light up when we do acts of altruism. We are spiritual creatures in a physical body, and we're wired for spirituality, and we've evolved, if you will. There are no cultures that have survived in archaeology that did not have a profound spiritual and religious life. When we see a trait like that that's 100% universal, it means it was vital to our survival. That's why that trait is seen in 100% of our genetic offspring. So we are creatures of spirit as well. We've evolved to be that way.
David is in Pennsylvania on Coast to Coast AM. David?
Hi, Ian. How are you doing?
Good. You're talking with Dr. Alan Hamilton.
Hi, David.
Nice to talk with both of you. Hi, Alan. I'm a pastor, and I've been serving as a pastor now for about 14 years, and this program really interests me with the healing and things like that that come with spirituality. I had an experience that I wanted to share with the listeners and with both of you, and it was a quite an interesting experience. I was in church, and one of my church members stood up and shared a story about her nephew getting beaten over the head by a baseball bat and having his money robbed, and she asked the church for prayer. I felt like the Holy Spirit told me to go and talk to her after the church service was over with and ask her if she'd like me to go to the hospital and pray for her nephew. And, of course, she was excited about that. I didn't get the chance to go to the hospital until Monday because of the demands that I had on me. But on Monday, I went into the hospital. The young man was in a coma, and the prognosis was not good. They expected him to pass away. And so I went there with my Bible and some anointing oil, and I asked the Lord to please help me and to see that this young man might be healed. And I was following the guidance that's given in James chapter 5 concerning laying on of hands and anointing with oil. And so I got into the ICU unit that he was in, and the nurse there at the ICU nursing station saw me, and she said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Sure, I'm here to pray for this young man." And she kind of snickered a little bit and showed me which room he was in. And so I went over to that room, and there was a doctor in there, and he was working on some of the equipment there and getting things lined up for the young man. It was on several different pieces of equipment. I said, "Are you the doctor?" And he said, "Yes, I am." And I said, "Well, that's great. You want to pray with me? I'm getting ready to pray for this young man." And he kind of snickered, and he said, "No, no, I'll leave the room, and you just go ahead and do what you need to do." And I noticed there was like a serious lack of spirituality on the part of the staff there. So I anointed the young man with oil by myself there with just the Lord, and I prayed and I asked for God to heal the young man, if for nothing else, just to show the hospital staff that snickered that God still is in the business of doing miracles and that he can still heal people. I left there. The young man was still in a coma, but the next week I was in church, and the aunt stood up in church and she said, "I just want to just thank you so much for everybody in the church praying for my nephew. He's come out of the coma. They expect him to live and make a full recovery." And I was very excited to hear about that. And I had been at the hospital at about 8 o'clock at night on that Monday. And so I asked her, I said, "Just exactly when did he come out of the coma?" And the doctors find out that he was going to be all right, because I went there and prayed for him. And I was wondering when that took place. And I had been there at 8 o'clock at night on Monday, and he came out of the coma at 10 o'clock that night. And so I just believe with all my heart that something happened there, that God did something special for that young man that they thought was going to die. And I really believe that God has a place for the physical medicine that takes place in people's lives, that there's a reason why we have that knowledge,
sure,
but that we can't neglect the spiritual aspects. And so I really appreciate what you're talking about, Dr.
Well,
Allen. I really appreciate it.
You know, it's interesting to see whether or not either the nurse or the doctor changed their views about spirituality in the role of recovery. That might be the true miracle.
Well, I think David brings up the point that very often the spirit needs just as much intensive care when somebody's ill as the body does. And I've heard more than one story of patients who literally you can see the monitors change. And we found out, for example, one man was dying, and all of a sudden the numbers on the monitor literally started to change in front of our eyes. And 3,000 miles away at that very moment, his granddaughter was praying for him to not die and to stay for her. And when he told us later when he recovered, he said, "I was crossing over to the other side. I was seeing my son who had passed away. And then suddenly I felt these arms grab me and pull me back." And it was at the very moment that his granddaughter was praying for him.
Mm. Mm. Very interesting. I had a similar experience with a kid in ICU. I will make no bold claim of the efficacy of my prayers, but it was interesting that the doctor that David was talking about said the exact same thing that the doctor said when I came in the room, and I said I was going to pray for this kid, and I said, "Do you want to come?" And go, "Oh, no, that's not my department," and left, couldn't get out of the room fast enough. I always remember that.
It spooks, Doc. It really spooks us. We're just so uncomfortable with it, and yet, the patients are asking for the dialogue. When we ask doctors in surveys, 75% of doctors believe in God. And yet it's a very tough conversation for us to tackle as a profession.
Deborah is in Wisconsin on a wild card line. Let's hope it holds on Coast to Coast for Dr. Allen Hamilton. Deborah?
Good morning, Ian and Dr. Hamilton.
Good morning, Deborah.
Good morning. I have a question, Dr. Hamilton. I'll take the answer off the air. And through your experiences, Have you come less to less with a fixed idea of the faith you might have been raised with, or have you pretty much set an idea of your particular faith? Thank you.
I think my sense of faith has changed dramatically. I think it's a much broader sense of faith, and it's not necessarily strictly tied to my religious faith as it used to be. There's really this sense of spirituality being something that all of us feel in one form or another, and it takes different forms for each one of us that are suited for each one of us. But I think my sense of religion has dropped away, and more my sense of spirituality has developed over time.
Michael, in Concrete, Washington, on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Alan Hamilton. Michael?
Hello, Ian. This is my first time calling in. I'm a long-time listener, and I want to thank you. And hello, Dr. Hamilton.
Hi, Michael.
I've just got a minute for you here. Go ahead.
Five spinal surgeries, two fusions, and the second one was after secondary to a pseudoarthrosis, and they used cadaver bone. And I was wondering if that cadaver bone could have any reason why my fusion didn't, you know, I was allergic to having, you know, someone else's bone in me.
Cadaver bone is often used instead of people's own bone, which is called autologous. It's essentially completely inert. And in fact, some people are using coral, believe it or not, from a coral reef, because it's just a scaffolding for your own cells. But there are some people who don't handle cadaver bone as well as others, but it's really nothing more than an inert scaffolding that the cells grow through, and eventually your own cells grow up through the cadaver bone scaffolding and take over, and they don't need it anymore.
I want coral. I think that's really cool.
It's coral reef, right.
I think that is really... That's amazing. We'll get more questions and comments for Dr. Alan Hamilton, The Scalpel and the Soul, with you coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. Alvin is in Massachusetts on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Alan Hamilton, The Scalpel and the Soul. Alvin?
Hi, good evening and many blessings to you both.
Thank you. You too.
I'm calling because I had an experience that can kind of back up everything that has been talked about this afternoon. This experience is actually between one of my best friends and myself. We grew up together. Ever since junior high school, we've been best friends. And one day during work, I get a voice that says, call your friend and tell him these words. And just the words came to me. I wrote them down, and I debated all day long on whether or not to go through with this, because I figure, you know, he's going to think I'm crazy, and he's just going to stop being my friend once I talk to him and I tell him I'm hearing voices. So the day went by, hit about 9 p.m. I was watching TV, and at 9 p.m. came around, my favorite program stopped, and an open spot it was one of those perfect moments. So I said, you know, let me pick up the phone and call him now. And just get it over with. So I call him, and he's like, Alvin? I'm like, yes, this is he. I'm like, I got something to tell you, but you're going to think I'm crazy. But God talked to me, and he wants me to tell you something. And, of course, you know, I'm expecting him to hang up or something. And he says, hold up, what was that again? And I said, God spoke to me this morning, and he told me to call you. And he's like, wait a minute, let me pull my car over. And he pulls his car over, and he says, say what you got to say. And I basically told him everything that God had told me. And it just happens to be that at that very moment, he, on his way home, he was speeding all through the highway and just not worrying what he was going to hit, what was going to happen, basically suicidal, just trying to end it all. And there was a red light, and he decided to stop at that red light, not run through it. And then he looked over to his left, and up, and he saw there was a cross that was lit up on a church. And he looked at the cross, and he says, you know, God, please help me. And he starts beating on the steering wheel of the car. And he says, you know, Alvin, pray for me. Because, you know, I had talked to him about God before and stuff. And he's like, you know, God, my friend Alvin says you talk to him all the time. You know, Alvin, please pray for me. And then he got really angry, he says, and he says, you know, Alvin's full of crap. You know, this can't be true. Why am I believing him? Nobody can help me. And just as he finished saying those words, the phone rings.
And it's me, you.
Just telling him that God spoke to me and that I had some words for him. And I spoke to him, and I
that's very put interesting. It out there.
His life turned around completely. He's never been the same person again. He's very successful in business and family, and his children are doing well. And I've become an ordained minister and a chaplain myself, and we're just seeing, you know, where the miraculous has really come true for us.
Alvin, I appreciate that. Very interesting.
What a lucky friend he is.
Let's get to Dan in Playa del Rey, California, on Coast to Coast. Dan?
Hi, good evening.
Evening.
In 2006, my son was in a car accident. He was in a coma. He had a double brain contusion. And whenever I would go to visit him, he was in intensive care. He was in a coma for 4 days. And then when he came out of the coma, he was blind for 4 days. And whenever I would go to see him, you had to make a phone call. And when I would walk in the room, he would be yelling for me. And all the staff, the emergency room staff, they all had the creeps. And so I was asking them if he was always yelling for me. And they said, no, it was only when I would come to visit him, he would start yelling before I called into the emergency room to come and see him. And they told me that they didn't talk about it because it gave him the creeps. But that people, when they're injured like that, they have some sort of a sixth sense that they know when people are around them. I mean, there was no way he could have known I was there. I would be like 60 feet away, and he would start yelling for me, and I would be through like three different rooms and things like that. And it really shook the staff, but they said that it was kind of common for that to happen.
Dr. Hamilton?
It is common. It's an everyday occurrence. It's happening in every hospital every single day. And you're right. People are they're freaked out a little bit about it. But when we're alone, when we're with people that we trust, and you know we're letting our hair down, we'll go, "Did you see that?" And they go, "Yeah." And you go, "That was incredible. That was unexplainable. That was miraculous." And we go, "Yeah." And then you go, "How come we're not talking about it?" And they go,
"Right.
They'll think we're crazy." But this happens all the time, and I'm amazed when people come out of comas and they tell you how much in tune they are with their loved ones being there. And I always encourage families, the power of love is amazing. And even in a coma, even when we think the patient's completely insensate, their response to the people they love is completely different from everybody else.
Linda is in Windsor, Canada, on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Alan Hamilton. Linda?
Hi, Ann and Dr. Hamilton. Thank you. Thank you so very much for being on this program tonight. And what I'm going to tell you, what you're talking about, you're 100% correct. When my mother passed away, I felt, when she died, I felt a warm hug. And so did my sisters. And I said, "Mom has gone." And we thought, it was just awesome. We thought, okay, maybe not. Nah, it was a hug. My sister passed away this year. And while I was in the intensive waiting room, I had this sudden, caring thought, I got to go see her. Even though we were told to wait, I said, no, I got to go see her. As I got to her door, her three daughters were in the room. I stepped right into the room. She had just died, and I don't know how to describe this, but a wave of warmth, and I got another hug, and this time I knew in an instant, that's my sister, and it's real. I got one from my mother, my sister, and her daughters, who never experienced anything like that. They just, my one niece went, oh, my God. It was very warm, very caring, and she spoke to me. She said, "I'm okay." It was a small, soft voice.
Right.
I was distressed all through that day and evening about her condition, and my heart was heavy. And I'll tell you, that was real, and it does happen.
Very good. You're going to love this book. Again, the scalpel and the soul. And thank you, Linda. We've got Craig in Riverside, California on Coast to Coast for Dr. Alan Hamilton. Craig?
Yeah. Hi, Deacon Ian and Dr. Hamilton. How are you?
We're great. Thank you.
I got a quick story. One of my best friends, 25 years, fell off the top of a semi trailer, and they rushed him to the hospital. He had a shattered pelvis, and found out he was bleeding internally. And for 4 days, he laid up in the emergency in ICU, and they couldn't do surgery on him because the surgeons didn't know where the bleeding was coming from. They knew he was bleeding because they had a catheter in him, and the urine bag was being filled with blood. And they actually called in the pastor to pray over him and give him his last rites. And he said that he had a vision that he was totally knocked out, and he awoke into a light in the room, and the light was very small. And as he tried to open his eyes, it got closer and closer until the whole room was lit up. And he said he seen the presence of God in that room, laid hands on him and said, "You're going to be fine, Gary." And the next morning, his sister came to the hospital. And Dr. Hamilton, you could attest to this. Everything that the nurses or the doctors do have to be logged in. The urine bag was filled the night before with all the blood in it, and his sister noticed that the urine bag was clean. She went to the nurse's station and asked the nurse, "Did you guys change my brother's bag?" And they said, "Ma'am, we were very busy on the floor last night. We haven't gotten around to it, and we'll be in there shortly to change that bag." And she said, "Well, somebody came in there, they looked at the log, and nobody had signed for it, and the bag was changed. How it got changed, I don't know. I don't think anybody changed it, but the bleeding had stopped, and he fully recovered, and I just wanted to get Dr. Hamilton's opinion on that, and God bless you both. I'll take my answer off the air."
Well, I think that, the urine clearing and everything else, it's just a wonderful story, and as you say, the nurses do log everything. So I'm very happy to hear your story about your friend Gary.
Ben is in Baltimore on Coast to Coast. Ben?
Yes. Hello. How are you all doing this morning?
Terrific. Thank you.
Good. I have a story also. When I was in my 20s, I was experimenting with my late teens. I was experimenting with drugs. And I went down this tunnel. That's the first time that I experienced this tunnel. But last year, my mother, made transition. And I was sitting, and I had a dream. I was sitting on the steps. So she came to me in the neighborhood that we grew up in. We were living there all our lives. And she said, "Come and take a walk with me." And she looked real young because I was the oldest child. I remember when she was the younger. And so we walked around the corner, and both sides of the streets was lit up real bright with this light. And so I was standing there with her, wondering what we were going to do. And so she said, "Well, I have to go now." And she took off, and she started running into the light, and she disappeared. A few nights later, I woke up in my sleep, and she was standing at the end of my bed, just as she was when she made transition. But next to her was my wife. And I've heard of people seeing things. And I was awoke. This wasn't a dream.
Right.
I woke up. I saw this. Seeing, people who had made transition. But very few people have I heard say that they saw a living person with
right.
the person that had passed on.
That is interesting. Dr. Hamilton?
No, it is interesting. I think so many of us have felt the presence of somebody who's passed over and felt that they were somehow looking out for us and involved in protecting us and helping us through this life. And many of us have felt the presence of those people in our own lives.
Dan is in Pennsylvania on Coast to Coast for Dr. Alan Hamilton, The Scalpel and the Soul. Dan?
Good evening. My story, my defining story, happened about 30 years ago when I was going through my laboratory rotation at Malcolm Grove Medical Center, which is part of the Andrews Air Force Base. We had two children, 7 years old, that were suffering with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and they both became friends, and they weren't really resolving well. And I had a habit of going through the wards before I went to bed, and I went into the pediatric oncology ward, walked through the doors, and they were almost hospital mascots. I mean, these two kids were great, those 7 years old. And I saw the mother and the father of the one child. The mother was wailing outside the door, and this was around Christmas time, and I thought, oh, God, you know, I was expected to see the blue team come out next. And I walked up to the room, and they're both in bouncing on the beds having fun. And I swear to you, I walked in, and I said, what's the matter with your mother? And the little girl looked at me, and she said, well, they wanted us to go home for Christmas, but Jesus said we're going to spend it with him. And this sounds like I'm making it up, and I'm not. They both died within a half an hour of each other on Christmas Eve. Hmm. You know, and you see stuff like that. Yeah, any clinician that's been around a hospital, I mean, if you can get them to admit it, the stories are just phenomenal.
Well, there's something like that in the book, and we don't have time for it now, Dr. Hamilton. But that mother child reunion story defies the odds as well in a similar way. Mathematically,
Dan is you know, I appreciate your sharing story like that, and I completely agree with you. It's pervasive throughout medicine, and yet we sort of have held the lid on it instead of sort of opening this dialogue and saying, look, this is an amazing laboratory of the human spirit, and we're getting to witness these incredible, extraordinary moments of how spirituality works and how the supernatural may work. And yet we're not feeling comfortable opening the dialogue and having a conversation about it.
I think we have time for Paula in Concord, North Carolina, on Coast to Coast. Paula?
Hi, good evening, guys. I have a crazy question for you. When I was a child, I used to be able to look at people and see their auras and be able to tell if they were getting sick or if they were, in fact, sick or dying. And I also used to be able to tell if someone was, I used to call them evil. And sure. I don't see this anymore, but if I meet somebody that I feel is this type of person, I'll start shaking, I'll start feeling nauseous. And I wonder if the doctor ever had a similar experience.
Not with evil, but I am often surprised how children have intuitive feelings about it. I'm curious that you lost that gift. But we often hear about children who have that gift, and then as they get older, it goes away or it atrophies a little bit. But what you're describing about the auras around people is sort of a little bit what Ian and I were talking about earlier.
Yeah, I think she'll enjoy the book quite a bit. Yeah. And there are lots of people, though, who do have that sense of evil, and it is often children. There's sort of an intuitive sense of there's something about you that's not adding up, and it's a kind of gestalt that, you know, perhaps rationally nobody can explain, but it happens. Let's do last caller then from Cindy from Utah. We have time for you, and then we'll have to wrap things up here. Cindy?
Yes, Ian, Dr. Hamilton. I was wondering if you ever had a patient or patients tell you that they felt gray before they expired or had a heart attack or anything like that?
Felt gray.
Gray.
Gray, the color gray.
I have had patients who've described a sense of, or that they've described auras to me, not necessarily gray. I've had patients who've said they've had a sense of blue, green, and yellow and white light, but I've never had gray.
Cindy, does this apply to you?
Yes.
Are you feeling gray?
No, but I coded 3 times in one night, and all that day, the only thing I could describe was gray. I just felt gray.
You felt inside gray, or you felt outside?
Inside.
Inside just, gray.
Just like everything was just gray. I can't describe it. It was kind of like smoky, smell. Not really a smell. It was just gray.
How do you feel now?
Wonderful.
what color are you now?
Clear.
Okay, that's a good thing. Interesting, the color of clear.
That's clear is a very good way to describe it. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
The scalpel and the soul, encounters with surgery, the supernatural, and the healing power of hope. Enjoyed this conversation so much. I hope that other people will be referring others to hear it, too, on the website at coasttocoastam.com. And when there's a follow-up book, will you let me know?
I promise, Ian. Thank you for a wonderful evening.
Thank you for making room for us in your busy schedule and for making this a special Sunday. And I hope everybody else out there takes the lessons of what we've been talking about tonight to heart and incorporates that into the best of your living years ahead this week. Deus tamat. And I do, too.